Hey, everybody. This is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is the 9th of December, and what's coming up today is a segment from our After School Sucks special. That is a special little show that we do after our regular live LRN/Ustream show every Thursday night. That show goes from 10 to 12, and then we do the After School Sucks special from midnight until we're all ready for bed. And we had a listener call in, and he had some questions about a parenting issue. Actually, maybe he didn't have questions. I think he just wanted to get some things off his chest, and I was glad that we were able to provide an outlet for that, even if I didn't know, you know, everything that let's talk about that. The listener called in, and he had just yelled at a couple of very young children about something that was kind of a safety issue, but obviously there were other elements to the story as well. And I was kind of at a loss because I really wanted to provide some concrete advice or reflection on what had happened, but I could only really lean on my experience working with kids in a residential setting from many years ago, which I understand is very different. Now, Osborne is a parent. He was helpful in this conversation. We also had Marcus with us. He is a new co-host who might show up once in a while. He lives out in Keene. But I thought I would include this because this is one of the things that I really like about doing the live show, is that we can have some audience participation and dialogue. And I know there are thousands of people who will hear this who have never checked out the live show. So you can watch us on Ustream. You can participate in our chat. You can call in. And I really encourage you to give it a try at least once. Interestingly enough, it was the next day that I listened to this NVC workshop. A gentleman being interviewed was named Jorge Rubio, and I found his talk quite helpful and kind of wish I had heard it before Tim's phone call. And, you know, one of the things that he talks about, the whole piece is about, I want to say, about an hour, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but part of his discussion is supporting children and our attitude towards emotions that is most constructive when working with young people in whatever kind of capacity, parenting, etc. And emotions are okay. You'll hear Osborne say during the show that it's okay to express anger, and certainly you can add a range of other emotions to that as well. Parents should not be robots. But there's a big difference between fully expressing emotions and doing it in a careful and thoughtful and really tactful way. And that doesn't mean repressing how you feel. There's a big difference between what Rubio calls containment versus repression. I think the phrase he uses is learning how to ride our own storms and fully or getting a fuller understanding of not just how it affects others when we can't contain it, but how it affects us when we repress it. Because kids know anyway. Kids hear tones through megaphones. Whether a person is, you know, opening up and engaging with what's going on inside them, or they're trying to shut down and constrict it, the kid is going to hear those tones come through anyway. So it's okay to open and engage with conflict. You don't want to model repressed anger for anybody you know, that you're in that situation with, whether it's a teacher, parent, the situation that I was in this this residential school. So anger is this opportunity to go deeper and to understand more, and not feeling like in all of these situations, like I guess in Tim's situation that you're going to hear about, there is a safety concern. And that is an extra consideration. I do understand with young children, yes, there are things that they can do there where they can wind up hurt. But one of the situations that I think most people could identify with is where you're dealing with a friend or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or a family member, and they are in, you know, some kind of crisis where they're expressing frustration or sorrow. And in that moment, it really feels like there's a right thing to do, and I just don't know how to do it. And I think I felt a little bit like that in this conversation, but I think it also feels like that for a lot of parents. Like, there is a formula. When Junior does this, do this. And that's just, that really is non-existent. And people maybe rely on these playbooks where, okay, well, if I'm confronted with this situation, whether it's a kid doing something that's dangerous or it's a peer having some kind of emotional crisis, I need to make them feel better. You know, in 5 minutes, they should be laughing if now they are crying. Or when we're talking about young people, they need to see things from my point of view, or I need to get obedience. And one of the things that I learned from listening to this Rubio talk was you really have to examine intent. And the intent in all of these situations should be to connect, and really not anything else. He calls it non-dramatic presence. Just connect. Don't worry about fixing, distracting, consoling. And that can be really challenging. It could be really hard to not want to, you know, because you see it as helping, making a situation better. But especially with kids, like, they should know emotions are okay. And for me, from my point of view, from what I've learned and what we talk about on this show, when you think about that, the schools, that's a very dangerous place for young people. Rubio asks a question in this talk, how do you make a child violent? And that might be actual, you know, physical acting out violence, but maybe just even a person who tolerates violence, who isn't horrified by violence. Maybe they just support it in a remote way. Like they tolerate other people doing violence on, you know, supposedly on their behalf. I don't know if you know any situations like that. But what leads to a child either being violent or tolerating violence or cheering for violence? Well, number one, they're not respected. Number two, there's no recognition of their presence as an individual. And number three, they wind up with a real sense of powerlessness because they're subjected to this system with no, what Rubio calls care quality, with an absence of care quality. They don't matter. They don't affect what's going on there in a meaningful way. And self-efficacy is a need for young people. It really, you know, once they get to these different stages in their development, yeah, they want to feel efficacious. And the world that they're growing into doesn't provide them with a lot of opportunities, regardless of what stage they're at, to do that. So that's one of the things that you'll hear us discuss with Tim during this call. And I will say this from my experience. The motivating emotions behind a lot of the conflicts that I dealt with when I worked with young people. So we're talking like from the year 2000 to the year 2006, roughly in my career. The emotional motivators in those situations were either, number one, resentment. And that was often resentment about being held back, you know, or being restricted or not being trusted. And, you know, the default position in these schools was like, well, you're here, so you're not trustworthy. So, you know, we need to watch every move, especially in this specialized program that I worked in, that I was the lead teacher in for a couple of years. And, the other one, I think, was that need to feel efficacious. I did a show a couple of years ago about bullying called The Mutually Destructive Exchange. And one thing that I forgot to include in that show, since we're talking about some of my experience that goes way back here. But first, I think in the show, what I was talking about bullies, right? And maybe like your stereotypical bullies in when we think about high school or in a Revenge of the Nerds movie or whatever, like culturally who people consider bullies, like the jocks. And we talk about all of the aspects of their lives that are controlled, and what they're really looking for is some control. What they really need is some control over their own lives. But memorable moment for me was like in the first 3 weeks that I worked at this residential school. So I was still in college. I was what was called a residential counselor in the dorms, right? And I worked in the East Dorm, which had the reputation through the school of being the place where the best kids were, seriously. And there were 18 kids living in that dorm. And there were four staff, And bullying had been a problem. We called it getting punked off, you know, so kids were punking other kids off. And the supervisor, this guy Anthony, who I think I mentioned a couple times before, you know, he was saying that the kids who are the biggest bullies in this building are the same kids who go to the executive director of the school's office, and behind closed doors, they cry about how homesick they are and how sad and scared they are. And then they come out of that room and they treat everybody in the rest of the school like shit. And you should know that. And it was kind of a way of shaming the bully. But to think about it now, yeah, we're just talking about a real expression of all kinds of needs that aren't being met. And of course, it's an unhealthy, miscalculated way to trying to get that need met. But like, yeah, I can have an impact. I'm getting a reaction. And this is really, I think, a behavior that we see more in younger kids. We'll talk about this as well. And I don't mean the bullying part of it. I mean the getting a reaction, right? And bullying is more about, you know, getting that reaction from peers. We're talking now with younger kids more about getting a reaction or a response or attention from a parent. But the adult emotions in a moment of conflict can, from my experience, certainly give the person who is doing the behavior what they think they want, which is what they need, but it's kind of a dangerous shortcut to take to getting that need met in the short term, right? And that just sets up a whole pattern that is very unhealthy. The emotions also kind of this double-edged sword as far as like, it's certainly okay to have them, but I know several times in my life with kids and with peers or in relationships, you can kind of in the moment go over the edge or over the top. And that's something that, especially with parenting or with, you know, working with kids in the capacity that I did, really needs to be dealt with through a more proactive approach. So that is mentioned as well. And I recently had a conversation with my brother. He had a problem with his 13-year-old, who is his stepson. There was some conflict. It doesn't matter. We don't have to get into what it was about. But he asked me about it afterwards. And I said, you're not doing anything in the moment, right? Where the emotions are escalated, that is a waste of time. We talked about this a couple of shows ago. And what I said to my brother was, there were situations in the past for me where I was in a conflict with a young person that I thought had the potential, and they often did, to escalate to violence. I would have to worry about being attacked. I would have to worry about the possibility of having to physically restrain a kid. This is something that we did. It was called NAPI, which ironically stands for non-abusive physical psychological intervention. It's basically like you use the person's arms, you spin them around and use their arms as like a straitjacket and usually bring them down to the ground and put your weight on top of them until they calm down. But I wasn't into that. What I said to him was these incidents where there would be the possibility of violence, very scary, very tense situations, I could have the same discussion, the same issue 24 hours later with the same kid in the same environment, and we could laugh about it. The emotions in the moment, the tension, the anxiety, you have to think about how these kids were treated before, you know, by authority figures during times of conflict. So what I would have done before, really up until, honestly, very recently, is I would say, oh, they're just not emotionally equipped to handle crisis and they can't make the right decision in that situation. And that may or may not be true. I certainly observed kids in this school de-escalate conflicts by themselves with peers and with staff. Right. But it would be the normal position of the authority figure to just put it on the kid. Right. Whether we're talking about parents, was certainly holy shit in the schools. But one of the major factors in that conflict, or, you know, what might even be approaching a crisis, is the sense of urgency that the so-called authority figure assigns to that situation. So examining intent is very, very important. And I think one of the questions that is very common from parent to child, teacher to child, is why the hell won't you do what I want you to do right this friggin' minute? And not why do I want you to do this thing right this friggin' minute? And that might be a very important question, because there might be a way, if the uncontained emotions throwing all of that anger or disappointment or frustration or whatever at the other person wasn't there, and the right questions are asked, there might be a way for both people to walk away from that situation with whatever needs they have met at that point. I understand that this is a different challenge with younger children, but, you know, most human behavior is about getting needs met. And one positive here, this is something that I've learned very recently, is that even these tragic expressions of unmet needs or trying to meet needs in a short-term or myopic way, even a potentially self-destructive way, an opportunity still exists there because the need is being identified. So I think an important thing for parents or teachers or teenagers to understand is that no one is going to be perfectly metered emotionally all the time, but the opportunity still exists to deal with that. Marshall Rosenberg uses this expression frequently, nice dead people. Right? There's a lot of nice dead people walking around out there. The walking nice dead show idea, maybe. But yeah, if you can't, if you just have these robotic responses, or you repress all of these emotions that provide so many opportunities, gosh, that goes nowhere good. And if you're a parent and you do that, I mean, if just nothing that a child does seems to have any impact on you to them, how are they going to feel about their presence in the world? I think that that's very, very important. And it reminds me of the podcast that I used a clip from about 10 shows back. Maybe it wasn't that long ago. The show was called Breaking Free. And I used a pretty long clip from a podcast called You Made It Weird with Pete Holmes. And he was interviewing Adam Carolla. And Adam Carolla, just I'm paraphrasing, but he was saying something like, geez, I would have taken getting yelled at once in a while. Right? At least I would have known that my parents, these people who were supposed to be so important to me, were alive inside. You know? I have to think that that would be a terrible feeling for a young person to grow up with, especially in those very early years. And like I said, what does it lead them to feeling about their own presence in the world? How do they ultimately wind up acting to feel as if they are efficacious, to feel as if they really even exist? That's a very important consideration. So, you know, every single one of these things is a learning experience, and I hope for some of you, maybe the show can provide that today. You know, I just, long story short, or at this point, long story long, I wish I had this insight when we had the conversation with Tim, but I've shared it with you now, so hopefully that is helpful. I hope you enjoy this. More stuff is coming very soon. Thanks for listening, and take care.
Survived before that.
Hold on, we're getting a call from Tim.
Oh.
Hey!
Hello? Tim, are you there? This is new. This call came in through Facebook.
Oh.
Oh, a Facebook that call. Can happen.
This is a new thing. Let's see if this works. It says it's installing Facebook video call plugin. All right. Well, through the magic of editing, that fiasco will be out of the show. But what's on your mind tonight?
I just wanted to bring up a situation I had with my two children. And they're twins, and they're just a little under 2 years old.
Sure.
And they are constantly playing with the blinds, right? And they're breaking them. And we try reasoning with them and talking to them, and it works for most things, telling them that things aren't a toy.
Sure.
But the blinds is one thing that it just doesn't seem to work no matter what we do. And So I had this moment where I was telling them all day not to play with the blinds, not to play with the blinds. I tried distracting them, playing with them, doing anything else I could think of. And somewhere my brain just snapped. And I ended up yelling at them. And it was pretty bad, and probably one of the only times I've actually like yelled at them.
Yeah.
And I could recreate that, but it was terrible.
No, I certainly I understand what you're saying. And how long has this gone on for?
It's relatively new, and they were just kind of playing with them and poking out of the blinds, and you know, they're just having fun pretty much. And I think they like to have fun with things that mess with me like that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, why do you think that would be? Like, why do you say that?
I don't know. I think it's just kind of the reactions that I have. I think they like to see what kind of reaction they get from the different things that they do.
Did you try anything as far as like a resolution with them after this happened, or what was their reaction? And then what did you do?
That's kind of what I wanted to explain, was their reaction to the whole thing. And I don't really want to recreate how I yelled at them.
Sure, but, no problem.
It wasn't really bad. I mean, it's just more than I normally would ever in my life do. Mm-hmm. But after I yelled at them, one of them, they were watching Elmo's World, and it was all about school, which is just messed up, like they were mocking me. But one of them started pretending to play the piano and started repeating, school, 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 school. Like, the moment I did that, and he was just distracting himself from what had just happened, but I thought it was hilarious that it was about school.
Yeah.
And the other one just sat down on the couch and went completely silent and blank and stared at nothing and just didn't do anything, didn't respond when I talked to him or anything at all, and just climbed on top of me and put his head on my shoulder and started silently crying.
Hmm.
And that's pretty much what got me. I mean, it's not just what I did, but how they reacted.
Well, two very different reactions, two very different ways of dealing with that.
Yeah.
Well, I would think that at 2 years old, obviously, there's probably some very serious limitations to understanding exactly how your actions can affect other people emotionally. And I don't think that, obviously, they don't have the context of, you know, part of your concern, and tell me if I'm being presumptuous or tell me if I'm off track, is like, you know, blinds cost money, and you don't want to, you know, set a precedent where it's okay to just rip things out of off the wall, out of screws. There's concerns about safety and all of these things they really might not be able to fully understand. But at the same time, even though they might not understand the full picture for you, they have a need, even though they might not know the best strategy for getting that need met, to feel efficacious, to feel like they're real people in the world that they kind of see happening around them. So that getting a reaction out of you is maybe not the best way of meeting that need, but it does, in a sense, meet it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I understand. I know that actions like that happen a lot less when they're interacted with more often and played with, and I don't know. It only really happens when I'm distracted, like I was making them dinner at the time.
Okay.
And I know that every rule in our house has to seem to apply to everyone. So if they can't play with something, nobody else can.
Right.
You know, if something is not a toy for them, then it's not a toy for other people. Like, I tell them to stay out of something, but if somebody else goes in there, it's perfectly fine for them too.
So a couple practical things, Tim. First of all, have you ever heard the expression, "That's why we can't have nice things"?
Yeah.
Yes. So this is a clear case of that, right? So first of all, one thing you could do is get rid of the blinds and like thumbtack up like some sheets if you need to cover the windows.
That was the plan. They're open now.
Second thing is like you mentioned, like the universality of the rules. So if they see you like opening and closing the blinds, then they're going to want to do it. So maybe what you do is when it's time to open the blinds, you bring them over and say, "Hey, I need to open the blinds. Can you help me do this?"
Yeah, I think it's people looking through the blinds, like not necessarily us, but when they see other people doing it, they want to do it also.
Oh, when people in your house look through the blinds?
Yeah. Like say if somebody just opens them up a little to look out the window.
Oh, I gotcha.
Yeah, like nosy neighbor type.
So those are very, those are two very good suggestions. I did a show recently, a non-live show about this story that I heard in Florida about these parents who made a girl, she was 15 years old, and they made her go stand at an intersection, basically with a sign that said she was bad. It was pretty much like the stockade in Puritan New England, kind of public shaming. And, you know, the question that I asked was, how can a relationship that's supposed to be this loving relationship get to that point where there's that much malicious intent on the part of the parents? And sure, they frame it as like, oh, it's the last resort, and we exhausted all our other options. And but that's like a really cruel thing to do. And then when television cameras show up, not say, we don't want to broadcast this to the entire country. The father, the stepfather jumps in front of the camera. And, you know, I started really thinking about how fast some of these things can spiral out of control for the very same reason that we were talking about on the regular show tonight, that no matter how intelligent people are, no matter how intelligent somebody is, emotion can really distort certain problems and pursuits and situations and interactions with other people. So that's not really a time when a problem already in progress is going to be resolved. So the proactive approach or trying to address these problems when it's not in that crisis mode or when it doesn't escalate to a disciplinary situation, like exactly what Osborne said, is the first thing that I would think of. Like, what's the because you can't really control them or what they think or what they do, but you do have a lot of control over the environment itself. And this is definitely something that I learned working with kids who weren't mine, but were certainly into testing limits and achieve whatever autonomy and freedom they could in a very unfree and restrictive place. And the way that would show up a lot of the time was by testing limits. Now, that's a totally different situation, but I learned that I would be more successful the more proactive that I was, and the more I not tried to take charge of them, but take charge of the environment, I think would be a fair way to say it. And I think it's totally understandable that you know, people get upset. I think kids need to understand that their actions, I don't want to say their actions have consequences like that lead to punishment, but their actions have reactions in how other people will feel about them. So, you know, it's obviously not optimal to lose one's temper, but I think that the earlier they can understand that their people have emotional reactions oftentimes to the things they do is fine, right? But I really think it's about maybe, you know, what Osborne was saying more, it's just about mimicking what you're doing, or that looks exciting, so I'll do it. Maybe it has something to do with the need for attention, and maybe it has something to do with it with a need for efficacy or self-efficacy, or maybe it's a combination of those things.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of them.
Just another point, those blinds can be really dangerous. My little brother, when he was your kid's age, I walked into his room and he was hanging by his neck from the cord. And
I kind of worry about that.
A scar around his neck. He had put it around his neck and jumped off his top bunk.
one of them already cut their hand on one that they broke.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they broke it and then cut their hand on it. As far as dealing with it before it happens, I don't really know about the blinds. Some other things are pretty easy. Like one of them is having kind of a tantrum problem, and I'm trying to teach him to calm down and like breathe and think about what's going on, but not while it's happening. Because yeah. I don't think that helps while it's happening. I think practicing it before it happens and then getting him to do it as it's happening is helpful for him.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good idea.
Yeah, I still haven't figured out that one with my kids. They're very tantrumy, which I don't understand where that comes from, because like we've never yelled at them at all.
You're pretty mild mannered yourself, right? Yeah, so they don't have like a lot of, and so is your wife. So they don't have a lot of models of explosive behavior.
Yeah, that's what, because I, of course, you know, like the rest of you guys, I listen to all the Molly and you episodes, and he talks about, well, my daughter, she's never had a tantrum because I don't yell at her. And if you don't yell at kids, they never have tantrums. I beg to differ, sir.
I think it makes sense when he says it, and it's good in theory, but lots of things sound better in theory and don't really work when you practice them.
My current theory is that it has something to do with that there's two of them, one being a few years older than the other. And I'm guessing that because, you know, the younger one was a baby, and so he's going to scream all the time because he's a baby. So maybe the older one feeds off of that and sees the screaming baby and think, well, I need to be a screaming baby too. And then the younger one sees the older one do it, and it's just like a snowball effect.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What number sibling are you?
One.
One? What's the next youngest? How many years difference?
Three.
So that was me and my brother. Now, I don't know, were you all close together growing up?
Yeah, lived in the same... Oh.
I know, Tim, we're kind of straying away from your story here, too, but there's also that attention deficit. And I don't mean that in the sense of the made-up disorder. I mean, there's this attention deficit that was there for your daughter, right? The attention that was there that now is being reallocated somewhere else.
Sure.
That was something that I don't remember being able to verbalize it or, like, saying to my mom when I was four, like, let's try to distribute this attention a little bit more equitably here. But I wonder if that's an issue, a different kind of issue with twins.
And I'd like to add that Sammy in the chat said, seriously, all kids have tantrums. They have emotions they don't know how to handle yet. Totally normal.
Well, I think one of the reasons why Steph might say that, I mean, and, you know, I mean, I take him at his word, obviously, is that he obviously has a lot more time to spend with his daughter. I mean, you're gone at least, you know, 40 hours a week. I think that the more hands-on experience that you can have, like even I was able to build better relationships with kids that weren't mine, that didn't really care about me, certainly didn't love me. I certainly didn't feel those emotions for them either. But just through exposure and I hate to use the word repetition, but through, you know, spending time with them as the older, more responsible person in that relationship, you could see the buildup to those situations. My situation was kind of like squeaky wheels get the grease. So my attention was more focused on, you know, one or two people, while you might be trying to distribute your attention as a parent a little bit more evenly.
I will say, like, what we'll do sometimes, especially on the weekends, is I'll take one kid and go somewhere, and wife will take the other kid and go somewhere.
Divide and conquer.
They're perfectly reasonable. Like I had Lysander last week, and we hung out in the toy store all day long, and he didn't throw a fit about not getting a toy. He didn't like ask for everything in the store. He's totally fine, but you get them together and then they start, maybe it's that attention competition or something.
That seems like it would make sense to me. And the feeding off, I would never have a problem with a kid one-on-one in any situation. That would be so highly unlikely. But when it's a group, yeah, that becomes much more likely that there's going to be something. Something is going to go wrong, for lack of a better word. But I think another important thing is to think about expectations. And this goes back to the proactive thing that Osborne was talking about, Tim, you know, forgive me for saying so, it might be a totally unrealistic expectation that a two-year-old wouldn't pull a string that was hanging there.
Yeah. I'm thinking of different questions to say, like, oh, did you try talking this out or that out? And then I remind myself, like, oh, two-year-old, like, you know, I could give you a suggestion, but I mean, you know, with a two-year-old, I don't know how
it's good. It's weird because they're very reasonable on some subjects and absolutely not on others.
Well, give me an example of that, reasonable versus unreasonable.
This is starting to end because they see us going into it, but we have a, I think it's called the buffet or something in our entry, and it has drawers and cabinets on it. Yeah. And we told them ever since they could walk that that wasn't a toy. So anytime we open it, they close it because it's not a toy. So we can't play with it, you know, so it's kind of, it's reasonable. If they're throwing a tantrum over something that is easily resolved, if you can bring that up to them, they will realize that it's easily resolved and resolve it. But then the blinds, I get absolutely nothing.
How long?
But they do smile.
Yeah, they get that twinkle in their eye, don't they?
Yeah, they're like, oh, you don't like the song, how about we do it more? Yeah.
Now, do you try to explain to them why you don't want them to play with the blinds?
Yeah, we've explained that they could be hurt and they destroy them.
Right.
Yeah, there's many times where they just don't believe you. Like, you know, stuff, especially like playing on the furniture, like you can see them like standing precariously on the edge of the couch and you're like, you need to get down because you're going to smash your face on the table. And they just don't believe you. Like, oh no, I can be completely careful.
That's
I would
never
happen. And then they fall and smash their face on the table.
Stand on the couch and we tell them they're going to hurt themselves. And they stand on the couch, we tell them they're going to hurt themselves. They fall off the couch, don't get hurt, and just laugh. And they're like, oh, he was bullshitting us.
Yeah. Or beforehand, they're like, that's preposterous. I just watched a man on TV walk across a waterfall on a tightrope. this is mild compared to that. I should be fine. You should concern yourself with other matters, parent. I've had the same experience with my niece who's six, and we usually go to my mom's on Sunday for dinner, and she'll talk to me, and as she's talking to me, she'll climb up on a chair, right? Now, it's just a regular, like, wing chair, but then she'll, like, climb up the back and, like, perch herself like a bird on the top of the chair and then start trying to, like, the chair is like a, like she's in a rodeo, like, jerks of the legs are kind of coming off the ground, and I'm trying to not say anything. And I just kind of like, I don't say anything. I just go over and put my hand on her and like guide her back down into the sitting part of the chair. And we keep talking.
It seems to me like people never stop this behavior because where people are continually asked and told not to do things. You know, you watch television, even they say, don't try this at home. You know, these are professionals. But, you know, everybody, that's life. Life is wanting to experience new things. You see, like, okay, I recognize there's a danger here. I recognize that there can be problems, but I think I can do it, right? Because we all think that we can do it. And I think that's a little bit of what, you know, kids in general do when they do these things, like stand on the edge of the couch or whatever it is. They say, like, yeah, I know there's danger, but, you know, they realize that they're in control of themselves, even though, you know, as an adult, you might recognize they don't have the full comprehension of physics to really fully understand that they're not in full control, but they feel they are. And that's something that I think, for the most part, doesn't leave people throughout their lives.
Well, I think part of what we see a lot on TV, on shows maybe like Tosh.0, and there's a combination, there's curiosity and there's kind of this don't give an effery.
That's a different thing.
And I think that kids, I don't want to say that they don't care, but they just don't know. They don't have that experience, and of course they're highly, highly curious.
Yeah.
So it's certainly, I mean, this is obviously it's hard work, as we mentioned several shows ago, several times, especially at that age where now, I mean, there's all these milestones throughout growing up where limits have to be pushed because there's new tools that the little person has. So like learning to walk and talk, and it's like, yeah, adults, I'm pretty much doing everything you are, you know, from what I see here. Like you walk, you talk, I walk, I talk. And then I think another important milestone is around the age of 15, when teenagers start to feel like adults. You know, they could have a job, they could have a girlfriend. When they're 16, they can drive a car or a boyfriend, have a girlfriend or boyfriend and drive a car. And then adults are even less impressive at that point, and they find that they're still being treated like little children. And I don't know how aware a two-year-old is that they're being regarded pretty much in the same way that they were when they were just a baby, but there's obviously been quite a few important developments and advancements and milestones for them in their life. I mean, obviously their memory doesn't go that far back, but they, I think that the curiosity coupled with a desire for self-efficacy can lead to, yeah, things being pulled off the walls and furniture being knocked over and people landing on their head and people hanging by their neck. And the best you can do is the proactive approach, really. And there's going to be blood, there's going to be bruises, there's going to be crying, there might be some stitches, you know?
There was a lot of stitches with me.
Yeah.
Before I go, my main issue with the thing was not only did I show them that that's an okay way to get their point across is by yelling at people or treating them poorly, but it didn't work. It possibly made it a lot worse. And so I made them feel bad, made me feel bad. Pretty much showed them it was okay to treat people poorly and yell at people to try and get your way. And it didn't work for anybody. Not at all.
Have you already, or have you at least considered talking to them and sharing with them your feelings that you're expressing to us now, that you feel bad about your reaction, and maybe explain to them how you were feeling at the time, how you were feeling frustrated and, you know, your different feelings, and then, you know, try to explain to them what you're explaining to us. Have you considered doing that, or have you already done that?
Oh, we do that regularly.
Yeah, okay.
Both my wife and I talk to them about everything, whether it's good or bad, and how it makes us feel, and ask them how they feel about it.
Yeah, that's good.
Now,
and have a conversation with them and not just scold them and tell them these things are good and these things are bad. Like, I can't even tell them that action is bad, because it's not necessarily bad.
Right.
It's them exploring.
That's important too, that there's that transition between the two, because one thing that I've seen in a lot of parenting, maybe a little bit in my own experience as a child, is they'll be, like my dad would yell, right? But then maybe he would go and have a conversation with himself. Like, oh, they're too young to understand. And he would come back and be very nice, right? And try to overcompensate. I think this is a fairly common thing, because what the in-between is that, well, you know, there's no point in really sitting them down and having a conversation, because they're not going to understand, like, all the pressure that I'm under at work, or, you know, my need to keep them safe, or however even the parent can articulate it to themselves in their own thoughts. So they just switch back to this overcompensation nice mode. And that kind of inconsistency can be very confusing for a young person, I think.
For anybody.
Yeah. And I mean, this manifests in other ways too, like where kids are split between two homes because parents are divorced, and, you know, one parent tries to compensate for what the other one doesn't do. That kind of inconsistency and that kind of unpredictability really, I think, and this is just my experience looking at some of Nathaniel Brandon's work, and I know Wes Bertrand has talked about this a lot on his podcast as well, that kind of inconsistency really can lead to a child feeling like their mind is not a reliable tool for making sense of the world. Because the parents, the adult behavior at that age is supposed to make sense. Like I said, I didn't mean to say before that kids, once they can walk and talk, they think adults are peers. They still obviously recognize parents as very important figures, not just in their lives, but obviously for their survivals. survival, and they really need to believe that parents are doing things that make sense. And when it doesn't seem that way, I think the takeaway for kids is something is wrong with me. Something is wrong with my mind, even if that's never a conscious thought. But if there's a tremendous, if they're dealing with a tremendous amount of inconsistency, they don't wind up, you know, trusting their mind to make sense of the world. And it sounds like what you do to, even if there is one of these incidents where, hey, you're a human being and you lose your temper and you have emotions related to all these concerns about, you know, safety and the quality of your home, et cetera, there is a transition between, you know, maybe a negative interaction and the next positive interaction. I think that's very important.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, Tim, you sound like a very loving and wonderful father just from, you know, the what I'm getting out of this phone call. And, you know, I would say, you know, don't, you know, you're doing the right things. Obviously, you know, you're unhappy with something that happened. But, you know, I grew up in a situation where my father was one of the most amazing and loving people I've ever known. My father was great. He was, you know, I can't say enough good things about my father. And he did a really great job, I feel like, you know, as well as my mother, you know, raising my brother and I. And there was some times when my dad exploded, you know, it happened. But that's not, you know, that's not who, that doesn't characterize who my dad is. My dad was, like me, a very emotional person, and I sometimes explode. I don't like it. I'm not happy with it, but it does happen sometimes. But that isn't what I carry as far as who my father was to me. You know, I was really lucky to have my father when I did. So sometimes, you know, things don't, you don't have the reaction you want.
Yeah. But yeah, it is very important to be able to express your anger when you have it. Right.
Yeah, I don't want to teach them that anger is a bad thing because it's important.
Right. So I don't know if is it a fine line between, you know, expressing anger and, you know, yelling at someone, or, I mean,
do you think you,
know,
you
I don't know.
Are there situations where you feel like you need to yell?
I never do, but sometimes in the back of my mind, I think maybe it's appropriate to. I don't know. I mean, I definitely, you know, I practice my, you know, angry voice, you know, and it's like an act that I put on.
A stern,
you know,
voice. Yeah, mine is the devil voice.
Yeah.
Which normally they think is hilarious.
Nice.
I guess that doesn't help either.
But what you don't want is like
scaring
whining
them into trying to get my way. And that's not really good.
Right. What you don't want is whiny voice, though. Right. Where it's like, guys, come on. I mean, that's going to get you nowhere fast.
Yeah.
I think it's potentially worse than yelling at them.
I was just talking about this recently in a show where I had a teacher's aide who would only speak in that tone of voice.
Right. That's where I remember that.
Yeah. From. And but,
that's something I have to fight against all the time because that's how I feel.
Like, oh, come on. Guys. Jesus. No, I've had that in my head.
Sounded like Larry the Liberal.
He's the worst. I think what I had success with was trying to stay as even as possible. And I never worked with very young kids, so I'm kind of, maybe I should defer to Jason on this. But I agree with what you're saying that, you know, actions have consequences emotionally for other people. There's nothing wrong with that lesson. I remember being yelled at as being kind of a frightening thing. And it's not really good for relationships to be afraid of one person in the relationship, which I felt a lot. And like my father, who would yell, my mother yelled a little bit too. They never did anything horrible to me, but the sort of unpredictability of that was made me a little uneasy when I was very young. But it doesn't sound like, I mean, if you're putting this much thought into one incident and we've been talking about it now for more than 20 minutes, which is great. You know, I obviously think that this is far beyond what a lot of parents do. You know, I think, unfortunately, I mean, this might sound completely foreign to people like us, but the conversation or the thoughts for the average parent might be, these friggin' kids, what's wrong with them, you know? And it's, again, like, too bad I was born a full-grown adult, so I could just never understand why they would play with the blinds. you know, I think that this reflection is good. I wish more people would do it, Tim.
I understand that I can't think what's wrong with them because they're still young, and most of what they do is a reflection of how I treat them. So anytime in my mind I might think what's wrong with them, I have to stop and think, wait, what's wrong with me? You know, how can I change to help them understand this better?
Right.
Oftentimes, too, they'll experience things in a way that, like, you have no idea where they get that from. Like, we play this game sometimes where it's like, well, what does mommy say? You know, what does daddy say? And little Lysander, he constantly says things like, daddy is a lion. He goes, roar. And, like, I never go roar or, you know, raise my voice or anything like that. Like, where does he get that from? But somehow or another, he's, you know,
maybe it's
perceiving me as being like some
facial hair,
scary monster or something.
Your facial hair looks like a lion.
Do you have a lion costume?
No.
Okay. So your two-year-old isn't outing you as a furry, like a closet furry.
No.
Okay.
No,
all right. No. So then that is interesting.
Maybe
if that's
he
not
is,
the case,
but
yeah.
You know.
And if you're furry, there's nothing wrong with that. It's neat. I'm just speaking to the audience.
I think one of the greatest things these two do is if I do happen to lose my temper even a little bit most of the time, they'll laugh. They'll laugh at me and remind me not to take them so seriously. You know, they're like, come over here and just play instead of being a dick for a moment.
Chill out, man.
Yeah, so that's good.
Tim, do you mind if I put this out in a regular podcast?
No, I don't mind. That would be fine.
Okay.
I enjoy regular podcast.
Okay, yeah, I enjoy regular podcast too. Anything else?
No. Thank you very much.
Thank
and,
you.
You guys all have a great night.
Hey, thanks for calling in, Tim.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tim. Thanks for sharing that, and thanks for participating, and hopefully we'll hear from you again soon. Give us an update.
All right.
On what you do with your window fixtures.
Oh, with the fixtures.
Thanks again. Have a good night.
You too.
All right, bye.